Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. And I'll tell you so.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about the latest on health and healing. Always good information from qualified sources so we can live a longer and healthier life. And we're broadcast all over the world. And so I keep in mind, what are the issues that people would like to hear about in other countries? So I take that into account as well. And I'll be sharing some universal truths today. Also today, time permitting, we're going to take a look at consumerism and public relations and probably the best presentation that I have yet heard on the subject. It really shows you why we have so many things we don't need being sold to us and we're buying it instead of questioning it. Also today, there is this white woman is speaking some truth. That's what it's labeled. And it's about vaccines. I thought you'd find it very interesting. So we'll be sharing that as well. And today I will complete my discussion about how did the founding fathers get their ideas? Where'd they come from? We had no Age of Enlightenment in the United States. So did they borrow from some of the great minds of Europe? I'll explore how Benjamin Franklin, at a very young age, he was a teenager, went to Europe. He wanted to meet some of the great minds, and he did. And because back then, people were easy to access. You could walk right up to a person's home and speak with them. And so you will know a little more about how the laws were written, our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and how they perceived the world they lived in, and how we can learn from that. So that's our show today. First up, from the New York University School of Medicine, an article published in the International Journal of Hygiene and Environmental Health talks about removing chemicals to make Teflon-like coatings has led to fewer low birth weights and less brain damage. Now, historically, no one found that those were associated. What did it matter what you cooked with? So you didn't want all the stains and hard-to-get-off stuff after cooking, so you used the Teflon. Big mistake, because indeed, when that was heating up, whether it was for eggs or anything else you were cooking, micro little particles were breaking off and going into our system, and it doesn't take a lot of a bad element once it's inside our body to play havoc, keeping in mind that if anything you take in, breathe, drink, or eat, is not used by the body in a constructive way, then the body perceives it as destructive. What to do with it? Because some of this stuff can get lodged in your brain. It can get lodged in your central nervous system and disrupt your nervous transmissions. It can get lodged in your fat tissue. In fact, overweight people have to be very aware that when you're losing all that weight, you really have to know what you're doing because you're then flooding the body with all the toxins, the pesticides, and heavy metals that were stored in your body, fat. So that's why it should be under supervision, and it should be loaded with things like apple cider vinegar and chlorophyll or chlorophyllin, and the way to naturally break down those toxins, get them out of the system. Also, you should be supporting your liver because your liver is what does all the detoxification, especially the nutrient glutathione. So both supplementing with glutathione, which is good, and taking alpha-lipoic acid, which is terrific, can help get rid of toxins in the body. So the government and industry efforts since about 2003 to phase out chemicals used to make non-stick coatings like Teflon have prevented more than 118,000 low-weight births and related brain damage. And this is the main finding of a new report based on an analysis of new mothers' blood samples gathered for a national health survey. And scientists behind the research conducted at New York University's School of Medicine say the studies have long linked the chemicals famous for keeping food from sticking to pans with high blood pressure, birth defects, and lower than normal birth rates and weights. And these damaging health effects were major factors behind the 2006 agreement between the Environmental Protection Agency and the American manufacturers to curtail and eventually eliminate the harmful chemicals in production, which was around 2014. So what do I suggest? I suggest stainless steel for cooking. You can also use copper, and you can use some of the glass. Those are all good. Those are safe. Not going to get yourself in trouble with those. But boy, when you go to those stick-proof plates and pots and pans, that's where you have problems. Next up, diabetes and obesity is behind 800,000 cancers. This is from the Imperial College London's Faculty of Medicine, and it was published in The Lancet's Diabetes and Endocrinology. They found that a high percentage of new cancers diagnosed worldwide since 2012, that's 800,000 cases, were caused by diabetes and excess weight. Now, we're talking about 12 types of cancer that were examined, and that's really important when you understand that if you're overweight, you're at greater risk of all these other conditions. Yet, in the United States, we did not want to fat shame someone, which we shouldn't. That's simply uncouth, lacking in civility and in sensitivity. If someone's overweight, all right, do you think they're not aware of it? Of course they're aware of it. Do you think that they don't realize the problems they're having? I mean, look at all of our grandmothers, even our mothers. Once they went through menopause, they started to gain weight, frequently belly fat. And it wasn't if they were overeating. It wasn't if they were not exercising. It's their whole metabolism shifts down into a lower gear. That means that after menopause, you must do more exercise and you must reduce caloric intake, because otherwise the thermostat on the body's metabolism goes down, and hence they're going to gain weight. So imagine how they feel if they didn't understand what to do to balance that. So we've got a big problem with weight in our society. A lot of people are just overeating. They don't care what they eat or how much they eat. A lot of them are eating just simply because they love the taste of the food, and they have not been taught what that means in their total health. But a lot of people are highly educated, understand what they should do, and still, for some, comfort foods take the place of fulfilling relationships. So there's a different reason for each person being overweight. Shaming is not the answer. It's very insensitive. So what do? You tell a person, read the literature, give them articles, and let them know that there is no such thing as being overweight and healthy. You can't have the two. Now, we'd like to think for political reasons and culture reasons that, yes, we can. No, you can't. You're going to be wrong on this. And this is where being wrong can end up with one of those 800,000 cancers. Because if you're overweight or if you're diabetic, you're going to have a shorter lifespan. You're going to die sooner. You're going to end up with a greater propensity of heart disease, stroke, heart attacks, diabetes, depression. And as you can see from this study, at least 12 different types of cancer. And cancer stemming from diabetes and obesity combined was almost twice as common among women than men, they found. And the two cancer-causing agents, being overweight or obese, about 25 of the body mass index, or BMI, was responsible for twice as many cancers. Now, when I did a weight control study, some of you listening right now were probably in it. It was a big study. I did it at the Jewish Center over on 86th Street because they had a large conference room, and they were very, you know, supportive of the idea that there every week there was a health discussion, and many of the people who were in that particular congregation would come up and sit in on the lectures. And this was for people who had been overweight or obese for a minimum of 7 years. then they were divided into five groups. And each day, out of a week, for 5 days, in the evening, people would come. And there were five different protocols that were given. Now, these protocols were as good as I could make them. For example, one was on stress, because we know that when you're stressed, you're going to eat more. It's anxious eating. We also know that when you're stressed and you're eating, you're not digesting your food properly. You're doing a lot of what is called dumping syndrome, where food accumulates in the stomach. It's not being digested. And why isn't it? Well, simple. Look at nature. That provides part of the answer. Even though we are civilized to varying degrees, depending upon our conditioning and upbringing and choices, we are also responsible for the response of the limbic system. We're primordial. We have very long related genes in us. So we're going to have a flight or fight response. And that means if you're asleep and suddenly you hear a noise at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're wide awake. Your pupils are massively dilated. Your blood is circulating through your body. Your blood sugar is raised. Your pulse rate increases because you may have to fight someone. You may have to flee. And your body has to be prepared for it. Animals are the same way. You could have gazelle and zebra and wildebeest all on the Serengeti Plain. And they seem to be calm and relaxed. And next thing you know, up comes a cheetah, up comes a lion, up comes a leopard, or pride of lions, and they go running. Now, do you think that what they were eating is going to be digesting? No. The body has the capacity to put all of its oxygen and blood and energy, what is called adenosine triphosphate, the actual energy of the body, combusts at the cellular level into the muscles so it can be as strong and fast as possible. So there's no digestion. In fact, frequently, they vacate the bowels and run. Well, what do you think happens when you're anxious? You see, the body cannot differentiate a real threat from a perceived nuisance or problem you're going through or something that's bothering you, and it's bothering you in a chronic way, so you just keep agitated. As far as the body's concerned, that is a real threat, and hence your digestion is going to be disrupted. So when you're eating under stress, you're not getting proper digestion. I don't care who you are. So that's why we should be calm when we eat and not wolf our food down. And we should take our time and masticate and chew it properly and not be drinking beverages with the meal unless a beverage is the meal. And if you want to drink, you drink up to 10 minutes before a meal, or you drink an hour after a meal. Otherwise, you're diluting your hydrochloric acid, and that interferes with digestion. And at a certain point, your digestion then dumps into the intestine, but there's still large particles of food not fully digested, not fully made into what should be the consistency of a milkshake. That's the consistency. It goes in as bolus, comes out as chyme, C-H-Y-M-E. And when it's in that liquid state going through your intestines, that's when the millions of little tiny follicles that come off the intestine, the jejunum, that's when it absorbs the nutrients and takes it into the body through the liver and recombines it and then sends it off to the cells and the organs where it's needed. But the way we eat too fast. We don't masticate our food. We forget that the stomach doesn't have teeth. And then we drink beverages, hot or cold, that disrupts digestion. And then we eat under anxiety conditions. We're anxious, got to get back to work, got to golf this down. The body can't differentiate that you got to get back to work from the fact that you could be fleeing for your life. So digestion is disrupted. We're not calm when we eat. We're not relaxed when we eat. I wish the people would eat in silence, so they can appreciate their meal, appreciate the food and the flavor and the aftertaste. But it's also making a big difference. So now one day you wake up and you haven't been eating right. You haven't been eating necessarily all the right foods, and you've got a body mass index and it's above 25. Big problem. So in this group, I gave the best way of de-stressing, everything about stress in the body, lectures on stress in the body. It was a 6-month study. And all the different techniques. Another group on another night had nothing about stress It was just about the perfect diet, the foods that you should eat and why. And another group, it was exercising. Exercise every way you can to burn calories and put in lean muscle tissue. So each day for 5 days, a different type of protocol. And one of those protocols had nothing to do with stress and eating and supplements and exercise. It was strictly upon what is the purpose of your life. That's it. And that's where I would discuss, like, anger, taming the beast within, fear, the great crippler, overcoming the dark side, love, and all the issues that are important at the foundational level of self. At the end of 6 months, with the best possible input I could give, the nutrition group, the exercise group, the de-stress group, the supplement group, averaged somewhere between 91 and 94% failure. The group that was given no information about how to lose weight, but everything about life, a 95% success rate. They lost the weight, they were healthier, they were happier. So that's why anytime someone comes into my office, I never give a protocol. You come to a retreat, I don't diagnose or treat anyone ever. There's no exceptions, by the way, zero exceptions. I don't care who you are. You don't come up and say, hey, Gary, what protocol do I take to cure this disease? And I just say, best that you get on a plane and go home, friend, because I'm not your doctor and I'm not here to do that for you. You want to learn how you end up getting sick with dealing with life issues inappropriately, and yeah, that I'll deal with. So that's why everything I do, everything is predicated upon the value of your beliefs, because the value of your beliefs determine your perception of things, yourself included. And that perception then becomes your reality. So you can't change someone's reality if they can't alter their perception, and they're not about to alter their perception if their ego, their self-esteem, their sense of importance, their level of conscious awareness of their achievements, the status of their education and social position, all that is weighing against ever doing anything completely honestly. And that's the challenge we have. So that said, I look at the results of that very important study, and then you look at all these programs, buy our food and you'll lose 30 pounds. Look at me, I lost 30 pounds. Well, yes and no. Look at the Atkins program, and he was a very close friend for a long time. Yeah, you can get someone to lose some weight temporarily, but it comes back, and does it stop disease? Isn't the whole purpose of eating right is to prevent the diseases? So we got to start looking at the larger and deeper picture on all things. So that's what this study showed. That's why I've said many times, I'll continue to say it, it is not humanly possible. Not humanly possible to be overweight and healthy. It's not possible. And yet someone says, well, I don't have any diseases. Do you know what's going on in 100 trillion cells? Does anyone, can anyone find out? The answer is no. So how do you know, because you have no classically defined diseases, that being overweight hasn't been a problem? Being overweight is a big problem. I'm just showing you one example of one study, and it's a big study, and it's an important study. And on our current trends, the share of cancers attributable to the two conditions, being overweight or diabetic, will increase by 30% for women over the next 20 years. That's millions of women who would die don't have to. From Tufts University, coconut oil fights deadly yeast infections. A common food oil, organic coconut oil, has been found to have potent antifungal properties that could literally save lives. See, the coconut palm is perhaps the world's most highly, in my opinion, valued oil when it comes to what nature provides us directly. And there's oils more potent, like black cumin seed oil, and olive oil is right up there also. But it's been prized because it can do so many things. And the scientific evidence on coconut oil is just, it is growing by leaps and bounds. It can protect your brain. It can protect your heart. It can even reduce stress and depression. So This is the latest. This is from the American Society of Microbiology in their journal. The title of the article is Manipulation of Host Diet to Reduce Gastrointestinal Colonization by the Opportunistic Pathogen Candida Albicans. And what did it do? It showed that the candida was reduced by 40% by using coconut oil. That's a big drop down. Most people would use antibiotics. I don't recommend that because then you're killing all the good bacteria and then you're building the potential for it. Antibiotic-resistant microbe. Coconut oil doesn't work that way. Read the article in the Reviews of Microbiology entitled Candida Albicans and Cancer. Can this yeast induce cancer development or progression? And it shows you why Candida is so bad, because Candida albicans overgrowth can play a significant role in carcinogenesis. So clearly, natural ways to keep the albicans levels at bay, the yeast levels at bay, are needed by a global population, and coconut oil is just one of the tools that can do it. And that's why I recommend a teaspoon every day. Next up in our final health nutrition, migraines linked to high sodium levels in cerebrospinal fluid. This is from the University Hospital Mannheim in Heidelberg University. I was at Heidelberg University. I was told by our FDA, in fact, a specific person there, that there were no studies anywhere in the scientific literature proving that injecting the stem cells from sheep embryo would make any difference to humans. It was just all nonsense. I went there. They had 500 studies that had been published in peer-reviewed literature at the University of Heidelberg's veterinarian hospital to prove just the opposite. Boy, did I learn a lesson about trusting bureaucrats and technocrats at the FDA or any other institution. But I had to go there for myself to determine that. And then I went to the Hands and Knee Hands Clinic, run by a man named Klaus Martin. I think I have photographs set up on my website. Pretty sure I do. And I interviewed all these people that had been coming about every 5 years because of the cells injected last about 5 years and help rejuvenate them. The problem was none of those people wanted to change any of their unhealthy habits. The idea was, why should I give up smoking and drinking and eating a bad diet? I can just come here every 5 years and get this injection, and it'll make me younger. What if they did both together? Anyhow, there was a lot of science behind it. So what this university hospital at Mannheim and Heidelberg University found was migraine sufferers have significantly higher sodium concentrations in their cerebral spinal fluid than people without the condition. And this is the first study to use a technique called the sodium MRI to look at migraine patients. And the findings were presented this week at the Radiological Society of North America meeting. Now, the people in this audience know that a migraine is a type of a headache characterized by severe head pain and sometimes nausea and vomiting. And it's one of the most common headache disorders. It affects nearly 18% of all women, about 6% of men. And some migraines are accompanied by vision and changes in our vision, odd sensations in the body known as auras. And diagnosis is challenging, as the characteristics of migraines and the types of attacks vary widely among patients, and consequently many migraine patients are undiagnosed and untreated. So this was just one of those. So what do we do? Well, we go on a low-sodium diet. Get the sodium out of our diet and put more potassium in the diet. I suggest supplementing with about 500 milligrams a day of potassium and getting out the sodium. Use lemon juice and lime juice and apple cider vinegar to replace that. And you want to try it, just bake yourself a potato and squirt maybe a tablespoon of lemon juice over the baked potato and put some pepper on there, and you think you have salt and pepper on that potato. And yet the lemon juice is terrific for you also. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall, talking on a telephone. Hopefully I'm going to be in a place where I can have my studio at least portable studio to go tomorrow or the next day, and so I can be a little clearer in how I'm sounding. But back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Tonight I've got a really interesting program at 7 o'clock. It's an extended special. I'm going to guess it's going to be 2.5 hours long. It's what I consider the problems of the Clinton dynasty. I don't tell people who to vote for, but when we listen to what the Clintons say about why each justified the run for president, he being president, but she was actually co-president. And look at what they have actually done, their actual policies. Now compare that with what you believe would make it a better world. And you're going to find them completely at loggerheads. So for those who do not know the true history of the Clintons, we will have an in-depth historical lesson. And I mean, it is factual. It has been vetted. Everything I'm going to share is a matter of record. But then you ask, why would anyone vote for these people? You can like them. You can befriend them. You can give them jobs. You can donate to their foundation, buy their books. That's fine. But putting them in the positions of power that they have been in and what they've done when they were in power, as governor, as Attorney General of Arkansas, 2 terms as president, New York Senator. Nope. That's something that any educated person would not want to do. Now, you may want to do it because you have an agenda beyond getting the best person into a position of power. And that's something I'll also discuss. It's 7 o'clock. You won't want to miss it. Please let your friends know also the Progressive Commentary Hour. It'll be 2.5 hour special, starting at 7 o'clock on the Progressive Radio Network tonight. Now, let's go to our little history lesson. Have you ever heard of the Sons of Liberty? Well, today they're mocked as being some kind of fascist loon group out in the Everglades someplace, but they're not. And do we know what the real Sons of Liberty stood for? Well, the Sons of Liberty was a formal underground organization. And it was created in the 13 colonies. It was founded in Boston, and the network quickly spread to New York and Connecticut and eventually to New Hampshire and Rhode Island, New Jersey, Maryland, and Virginia. It was a secret society. It was formed to protect colonies' rights and to fight taxation by the British government. Now, membership included all levels of colonial society, mostly made up of radical artisans and craftsmen, but also there were business men and women and journalists and lawyers and doctors. And they played a major role in most colonies in battling the Stamp Act in 1765. And by the way, that was an act by the British Parliament that imposed a direct tax on the colonies that required many printed materials in the colonies to be produced on stamped paper produced in London carrying an embossed revenue stamp. They also popularized the use of tar and feathering to punish and humiliate offending government officials. And women who were also supportive of the Sons of Liberty would rely on molasses and flowers that they tarred the women and associated with officials. So the group officially disbanded after the Stamp Act was repealed. However, the name was applied to other local separatist groups during the years preceding the American Revolution. And they were briefly revived in 1784 in New York to try to take away land owned by loyalists. Now, some of them also morphed into and became members of the Freemasons. And I mentioned yesterday, at the heart of the Freemason philosophy is morality. What is the highest form of morality? Because think of what we would not need in life if we all dealt with each other morally, where we respected the rights of other people, we respected their culture, their religion, their political views. They have a right to those. And unfortunately, when many things go wrong, when people commit egregious acts against each other, they're not coming from a moral place. And so the Masons look for who was the ultimate provider of moral clarity, and that was Jesus. Now, they did not view Jesus as a Messiah. Now, in 18th and 19th century Freemasonry, it was aligned with the Enlightenment thinking that was also called the Age of Reason. And when he was only 18 years old on his first trip to England, Benjamin Franklin's intention was to meet Isaac Newton. On a later trip, he befriended the English theorist of capitalism, Adam Smith. And from a Mason volume, it says, "We do not say to Christians that Christ was a mere man, whose life story is only a revival of similar older pagan stories. To do any of these things would be irreverent. We utter no such words. But for higher initiated Masons, Jesus was just a man. He was one of the exemplars, one of the great men of the past, but not divine, and certainly not the only means of redemption of lost mankind." And from official statements during a ritual, it says, "We meet this day to commemorate the death of Jesus, not as inspired or divine, for this is not for us to decide. Masons allow for members to choose to believe that Jesus was God or Savior of the world, but this is not Masonic truth. And those who consider themselves enlightened Masons hope that their unenlightened Christian brethren will realize that all specific dogmas about Christ are in error." Now, Masons are not 100% secret. Most people think that, but it's not true. A person can publicly say they're a Mason, but the rituals and higher teachings are kept secret. And most of the revolutionaries during the French Revolution were Freemasons. And you have to go back to their origins. It all started simply as a crafts guild of stone workers and architects who built the castles and the estates and the cathedrals from stone. And that was during the 12th through the 16th centuries when many of the great cathedrals and castles were built. Very little stone, by the way, was used in construction of most. Only the wealthiest, the church and kings and nobles, could afford stone. And the people who had the skills of chiseling the stone and knowing how they all fit together, the chemistry that was involved in their how they would create the right, all this was part of what they did. And originally, because the Mason Guild's close ties to the church, they were staunch Catholics and upholders of the church's theological and ecclesiastical hierarchy. Only secrecy were the mathematical and architectural and stone-cutting skills. Those they didn't share with anyone. And they were taught in lodges, and nothing metaphysically esoteric about the early periods of Masons. No rituals or nothing distinctly religious. They separated them from the rest of the medieval Christianity. And only distinct sign they adopted in the 15th century was a certain handshake to identify themselves as Mason Guild members in public, or in case they traveled someplace and how they shook someone's hand, the other person would immediately know they were a brother Mason or not. But higher mastery stonemasons, meaning those that were the ultimate architects and the creators, because an architect can design and engineer how a church, a cathedral, a palace, a castle can be built. But he's not the one building it. He's not the one that has to find the right type of stone that is not too porous and the right type of sealant that will not crack or wash away and how to get all of that stone to fit together. That was the Mason. And in time, the Mason Guilds acted like labor unions, And a master stonemason and an architect could become very wealthy. In fact, the church bishops and noblemen would compete in bidding wars to get contracts with top masons because some of these jobs would take 10 years to do. So you want to make sure you had the right person for that whole time. And master stonemasons also became powerful in upper-class society. And then in the late 14th through the 16th centuries, with the rise of the Protestant teachers, more challenges to the church authority and control over nations and populations, Protestantism challenged basic Catholic tenets such as the transubstantiation of bread and wine into flesh and blood. They didn't believe it. Why are you giving someone some bread? Why are you giving them wine, calling it the flesh of Jesus and call it the blood of Jesus? It's neither. It's bread and it's wine, you fool. So there was a big contention there over that idea of transubstantiation. Well, the Protestants were viewed as heretics, including in England up to about Henry VIII, before he broke from Rome and started a new Anglican church. But as heretics, Protestants were burned at the stake and tortured and quartered. In general, in its early period, Masons simply sided with whichever religious force held power. So at first they supported the burning of Protestants, but later after Henry VIII, when Protestants were then burning Catholics, they sided with the dominant powers. And the initiations are part allegory and part lecture and revolve around the construction of the Temple of Solomon and the artistry and death of Solomon's chief architect, Hiram Abiff. And the degrees are those of entered apprenticeship and fellowcraft and finally Master Mason. So when you hear someone's a 10th degree or 30th degree, that just is the level of their knowledge and insight. So the idea of Masonic brotherhood probably descends from the 16th century legal definition of a brother as one who has taken an oath of mutual support to another. And accordingly, Masons swear at each degree to keep the contents of that degree secret and to support and protect their brethren unless they have broken the law. They're also connected with Rosicrucians, and the kind of esoteric Enlightenment influence. Both groups grew and developed alongside each other. Rosicrucians attracted the intelligentsia, the scholars, the progressive theologians, the doctors, the scientists, the philosophers, and even the clergy. Masons attracted the entrepreneur and the businessman and the merchants. So throughout the 17th century, Rosicrucians and Masons interacted and borrowed from one another on Enlightenment ideas, and they would sit around. It was very common to go to a tavern and sit there for hours on end discussing ideas that had been written by some Enlightenment author and discuss, do you believe in this? Is this make any sense to you? How can we use this? So this was really a wonderful time. And between 1607 and 1616, two anonymous manifestos were published, first in Germany and later throughout Europe. And these presented the legend of a German doctor and a mystic philosopher referred to as Frater CRC, later identified in a third manifesto as Christian Rosenkreuz, or what was called Rosecross. And after studying in the Middle East under varying masters and possibly adhering to the Sufism, he was unable to spread the knowledge he had acquired to any prominent European figures. Instead, he gathered a small circle of friends and disciples and founded the Rosicrucian order around 1407. Now, the works are likely authored by Johannes Valentinus Andrea, a German theologian and a prominent member of the Protestant Utopian movement. And Utopians always look for the ideal in what human potential could be. They lived their lives that way. It began in Germany and spread across Northern Europe and into Britain. And in the early 17th century, Rosicrucian manifestos caused excitement throughout Europe by declaring the existence of a secret brotherhood of alchemists and sages who were preparing to transform the arts and sciences and religion and political and intellectual landscapes of Europe. And it attracted a network of astronomers and professors and mathematicians and natural philosophers in 16th century Europe, men such as Johann Kepler and Georg Jason Rectus, and John Dee, and Tycho Brahe, gave rise to this, what was called the Invisible College. This was, by the way, to become the precursor of the Royal Society, founded in 1660. And the threats of heresy changed these activists to hiding behind fictional secret societies and writing anonymously in support of their ideas while claiming access to this secret ancient wisdom. So just imagine, let me put this in a little different perspective. Let's just say that you were a progressive thinker. You didn't believe in the church because it was purely dogmatic, self-serving, and stupid. You also didn't believe in the peasantry having a philosophy because they just needed to live. You didn't believe in the mercantile class because everything was looked upon as selling you something that allowed them to have a certain standard of living, but generally no political or any other access because they were, again, they were in a middle-class, upper-middle-class position. You wanted to liberate your mind. You wanted to talk with people that would have something to say. You wanted to be excited by words. And there were very few people who had the literacy level to engage this. And a lot of those who were highly literate also were very orthodox. So all they could do is talk about what they had been told was acceptable conversation. They couldn't talk outside of that narrow box. And so what good did it do to go to a person's home where you're going to hear the same conversation ad nauseum? So you wanted something that was new and vital. So hence the movement of vitalism began, thinking of thoughts that were vital to the changing the nature of society. And they had to do this quietly because people would have thought they were nuts. And they felt that you needed an education, but you needed an education that allowed you to think. You needed encouragement of the sciences, the key to natural and national prosperity. This was kind of Neoplatonic concepts. You needed religious tolerance. You may believe in a god or a supreme being that transcended the religious sentiments of the 16th, 17th century and that all different religions could believe in. And many of the earliest elements of theism and Rosicrucian thought that gradually entered Masonry, you could also believe in. And then along came the Renaissance. And some will say it's the Renaissance, some will say it's Renaissance, it doesn't matter. It's spelled the same way. And who were the great minds? Who were the free thinkers? Who were those who did not see a boundary in their ability to live and create? Well, probably the best was Leonardo da Vinci. He was born in 1452, he died in 1519. And Leonardo was the supreme Renaissance painter, scientist, inventor, polymath thinker, and inquisitor. Then you had Michelangelo. He was alive at the same time, though he lived a little longer life. He lived till 1564. He was a Renaissance sculptor and painter and architect. And Michelangelo's artistic endeavors embodied the spirit of the Renaissance. But also you had William Shakespeare. He was born the year that Michelangelo died, 1564. He did not have a long life, but he was a playwright and a poet. At court, he was very popular. And then you had Machiavelli. Machiavelli was an Italian writer and a historian and diplomat and humanist. And he moved in political circles, and he created a new branch of political science based upon humanistic principles. And then you had Thomas More. If you saw the film with Peter O'Toole and Katharine Hepburn, Lion and Winner, you got a taste of Thomas More. He died in 1535, not long after. Actually, he died before Michelangelo, but after Machiavelli. More was an English statesman who wrote an ideal political system called Utopia, and he was considered a social philosopher and a Renaissance humanist. And then you had Copernicus, Nicholas Copernicus, same time, 1473 to 1543. He was a Renaissance mathematician and astronomer, and he formulated a heliocentric view of the universe, And then you had Paracelsus, and a Swiss-German physician and leading health reformer. And he founded the discipline of toxicology and pioneered the use of chemicals in treating patients. He rebelled against the medical orthodoxy of the medieval ages, emphasizing practical experience rather than ancient scripture. You had Galileo, and who created one of the first modern telescopes. Galileo revolutionized our understanding of the world, supporting the work of Copernicus. You had Kepler, a German scientist who played a key role in the 17th century scientific revolution. He created the laws of planetary motion, which influenced Isaac Newton's theory of gravitation. You had Martin Luther, a person I do not respect. I think he was just a psychopath, but he was leader of the Protestant Reformation. You had Erasmus, was a Catholic theologian who was also called the Prince of the Humanist. He was willing to raise questions about the teachings of the Church and not to rely upon blind dogma. The Catholic Church was always political, it was always dogma, and he shook things up. Today he's highly respected by the Church. And then you have the most important era, and that is the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason. And the Enlightenment, also known as the Age of Enlightenment or the Age of Reason, was an intellectual and philosophical movement that dominated the world of ideas in Europe during the 18th century. The 18th century was considered the century of philosophy. The French historians traditionally start the Enlightenment at 1715, the year that Louis the 14th died. But modern historians begin the period in the 1620s with the start of the scientific revolution. So what was the whole purpose? What was the larger gestalt of the Enlightenment Age of Reason? It was reason as the primary source of authority and legitimacy, individual liberty, civilizational and societal and scientific progress, not superstition, not alchemy. Emphasis on the scientific method and reductionism, religious tolerance, constitutional government, the separation of church and state, the birth of deism, especially among the educated elite. And the first American tome on deism was Ethan Allen's Reason, the Only Oracle of Man. Now, what are the main ideas of deism? Mostly, they took hold during the second half of the 17th century. Rejection of religious beliefs that are based on books that claim to contain the revealed word of God. They found that nonsense. Rejection of religious dogma and demagoguery. Most deists saw the religions of their day as corruptions of an original and said a pure religion was simply simple and rational. After all, what religion could do more than simply say respect all life, like the Jain Society do? And who was Gandhi most influenced by? The Jains and Leo Tolstoy. And they also were skeptical of reports of miracles. They didn't believe in miracles, prophecies, or religious mysteries. God could exist, and he could have created the universe, but they did not believe that more than that. Some but not all deists rejected Christianity and rejected the Bible altogether. The Unitarian Church is principally deists. Who were the people who influenced the American founding fathers? Francis Bacon, the English philosopher and statesman and orator and scientist. Bacon is considered the father of empiricism for his work and advocacy of scientific method and methodological scientific inquiry and investigating scientific phenomena, a unique human being. René Descartes was a French philosopher and mathematician and made a significant contribution to the philosophy of rationalism. And Jean Meissler, a French Roman Catholic priest, philosopher, first atheist writer since ancient times. Well, how could you be a Roman Catholic priest and an atheist? That was part of the Age of Reason. You could. Emanuel Swedenborg was a Swedish national philosopher and theologian whose search for the operation of the soul in the body led him to construct a detailed metaphysical model for spiritual natural causation. You had Spinoza, Baruch Spinoza. He was a Jewish Dutch philosopher. He was an influential rationalist who saw the underlying unity of the universe. He was critical of religious scripture and promoted a view that the divine was in all of us, and the universe was ordered, and despite its apparent contradictions, and needless to say, that did not go down well. He was hated. You had Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant was an influential German philosopher whose critiques of pure reason sought to unite reason with experience and move philosophy on from the debate about, well, rationalists versus empiricists. Then you had someone that definitely influenced our Declaration of Independence, John Locke. And Locke was a leading philosopher and political theorist who had a profound impact on liberal political thought. He is credited with ideas such as the social contract, the idea government needs to be with the consent of the governed. Locke also argued for liberty and religious tolerance and the rights to life and property. And when I talk with people today who are complete illiterates on the subject of government and ask, do you want a bigger government? Do you want a smaller government? Do you want a functional government? Do you want a government that you have some control over their actions? Most people are just, they don't know what. All these people did not want large governments. They wanted governments that the people had some control over. Today, we have no control over any of our government. David Hume, very important Scottish philosopher, historian, and essayist, best known for his empiricism and rational skepticism and advanced the doctrines of naturalism and material causes. He influenced both Adam Smith and Immanuel Kant. And Sir Isaac Newton. Newton made studies in mathematics and optics and physics and astronomy, and in his Principia Mathematica, published in 1687, he laid the foundations for classical mechanics and explained the law of gravity and the law of motion. And of course, one of my favorites is Voltaire, born in 1694, died in 1778. He was a French philosopher and a critic. Voltaire was instrumental in promoting republican ideas due to his criticism of the absolute monarchy of France. And then Jean-Jacques Rousseau was a political philosopher widely known for his social contract. He wrote in 1762, which sought to promote a more egalitarian form of government by consent and form the basis of modern republicanism. And you had Adam Smith, Scottish economist and philosopher, sometimes considered to be founding father of laissez-faire economic theory, but in fact argues for some degree of government control in order to maintain equality. Adam Weishaupt, German, founded the Order of the Illuminati. Note on the Illuminati, it competed with the Masons. Oh, there was a lot of cross-socializing between the two and their memberships. A lot of people think the Masons were the Illuminati. They were not. The official Illuminati died out around the 1830s, and a lot of the people keep blaming the Illuminati and all of our problems. They are just delusional. And who were the most important thinkers on founding fathers? Montesquieu, on Thomas Jefferson, Franklin, John Adams. That the government is supposed to maintain law and order and protect liberty and property. John Locke definitely influenced Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, because his view on government can only govern with the consent of the governed. And he considered humans as brute due to passion to overrule natural goodness. He was a humanist. Isaac Newton definitely impacted Benjamin Franklin. Adam Smith also impacted Benjamin Franklin. And Rousseau's The Social Contract definitely influenced Jefferson, Franklin, Adams. He favored direct democracy. Humans are born free and equal. That's what he believed. And the government is only a vehicle for carrying out people's laws. People are sovereign, not the government. Boy, have we reversed that in our society. And finally, David Hume influenced Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and that the Constitution is essentially there to prevent bad government. And Thomas Hobbes influenced John Adams. More of a monarchist, people will sacrifice their freedoms to government in exchange for order and security and have no right to revolt. Well, that was a mistake. So that's just to give you a little bit of background on how we got to where we're at today, where people are ignorant about the Constitution, the Founding Fathers, the Age of Reason, the people whose original thoughts coalesced into the fabric that we are now wearing today. And rarely do we look at a single thread of this fabric and ask, where did this come from? Who were the people? What was the environment and context in which they lived? If we did, it would allow us to take back our rights, take back our governments, throw out all politicians, and put people in place who are philosophers, people who are humanist, people who have moral values that respect and honor all life. We're not ready for that yet. We're not in enough pain yet. We have a long way to go. We have to have a lot more natural crisis, 10 times more than what we've had. We're going to have a Category 5 hit New York or some other place. We're going to have a volcano, major eruptions. We're going to have a complete collapse of our economic system when the dollar goes down the toilet in about the next 2 to 3 years based upon what's happening with Russia and China using gold to back up their currencies. We're going to see so much corruption, but instead of adapting to it, of this new form of reality television, we're going to have to realize that all these perfect storms happening sooner or later will tip the balance to we, the American people, who are not paying attention, will have no choice but to galvanize our attention. And in that moment, yes, then we will be in enough pain. Right now, we're just not in enough pain to do anything at any time, anywhere, for anyone but ourselves, except for the small group of people, and it's under 1% that are actually actively protesting, actively challenging the power of those who try to control our lives. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. And remember, tonight, the most comprehensive, in-depth analysis of the Clintons have ever been done on Progressive Commentary Hour on the Progressive Radio Network at 7 o'clock.